We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Listen to every MLB game live.
In the deep left center field, it is high, it is far, it is gone.
Stream minor league affiliates.
The Midwest League home run leader.
And watch the best baseball highlights and look-ins on MLB Big Inning. MLB At Bat is your all-in-one live baseball subscription for only $3.99 per month.
Deep left field, it's gonna go! Alvarez ties the game!
Subscribe to At Bat within the MLB app today. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
I wasn't necessarily chomping at the bit, but I do think that's about as ringing an endorsement as we could have gotten from Ray. It bothers me less than I thought it would is a win.
I will tell you this much. The biggest thing that bothers me about it is something that Rob Manfred will claim credit for, and he shouldn't get to claim credit for anything ever.
That's the way I felt about Bud Selig in the wild card. I hated Bud, and I still do, but he was right about the damn wild card. That's about as much fun as you can have in September.
But the other thing is Bud, by comparison, is a better commissioner than you thought he was because you saw how much worse it can get.
Yeah. See, I don't think he's a better commissioner than I thought he was. I just think I didn't realize how much worse Rob Manfred could be. That to me is a different thing. Bud was every bit as bad as I thought he was, but Damon's right. The wild card, much like this rule, is one of those things that sort of seems to go against everything that I knew baseball to be, and yet, once it's happening, I find myself enjoying it. And so even though I would say both of those things, Ray, sort of fall into the solutions to problems that don't exist category, I'm okay with them because, as it turns out, they were solutions to problems that maybe the problems didn't exist, but the solutions improved the status quo. So I don't have a problem with regular season goofing up extra innings. Like, if you make it to extra innings, let's just all agree it becomes a little more uneven. It becomes a little more turbulent. Things get a little goofier. That's just what happens in regular season baseball. And for the playoffs, we'll fix it. And I think that's a good way to go, honestly.
I think baseball is better only because the Cardinals never get to play it.
I mean, as a Cubs fan, let me tell you, 5 games for the Cardinals feels about right for me, too.
Screw St. Louis.
Ray,
they rally on Friday, though, against your White Sox, pal. You can't keep a good team out of the league in which it pays its dues.
Ray, you say that your biggest problem with the extra inning starting the runner on second base is that it's not consistent because it's not what is in the regular season is not in the postseason. Is that your primary argument with it in the terms that we're looking at it right now?
My primary argument against the guy on second base is puts undue pressure on a reliever which I think can endanger their health, because I think they tend to overthrow in the 10th inning when they're all of a sudden they walk out in the field and there's a guy standing at second base. I don't think that is within keeping of the nature of the sport. That said, in a 60-game season, when you are trying to see to it that you don't have the equivalent of the 5-overtime hockey game, I don't have as much of a problem, because you can ruin a bullpen with an 18 inning game. And when you don't have that many chances or that many days to recover from it, I think there's an undue punishment. But in general, I think it's bad for bullpens. And I think it sort of flies in the face of you earn everything you get in baseball.
Right. Well, it's a different world that we're living in. But you did say that your biggest problem was that it's a regular season rule that doesn't come to the postseason.
Well, that was my complaint about the designated hitter in the past, was that you get to the World Series, and if you're playing in the NL Park, the AL team all of a sudden loses a key component of its offense. And if you play in the National League, if you play in the American League Park, the National League is suddenly, gifted with a guy who probably hits .211, but that you're going to call a designated hitter because.
But you said you liked the difference between the leagues. Yeah, you said you liked that.
Yeah, I mean,
no,
well,
but
maybe
what
that
I want,
was me
no,
that
but
liked
what
that.
I'm, what I, what I wanted, if you're going to have, if you're going to have that, I would prefer no DH. Period. I wanted. You know, I don't mind the difference, but if you told me I had to pick one or the other, I'd rather not have the DH.
Well, in hockey, in the regular season, they take a skater off the ice for your overtime. In the postseason,
no, they don't. Oh, in regular season, yes, you're right.
In the regular season, they're playing 4-on-4 overtime hockey. In the postseason, yeah, it's still 5-on-5. So, you know, a sport that you love and stump for does what you claim you don't like about baseball. So,
I don't like the overtime rule in hockey during the regular season. I think you've bastardized the sport twice because you don't, you know, you don't play very much 4-on-4. And you very definitely don't finish with a shootout. In my perfect world, they would play every game sudden death. They'd have bigger rosters so that you could cover yourself for it because every team charters flights now. But in this specific year, when time really is of the essence, for me, you know, I'll eat a little bit on the baseball end, but if they come back with this rule next year, I'll feel like they failed.
I think it's a little odd that you're worried about relievers' arms with a guy on second in the 10th, but you want them to play for 18 innings whenever possible. Or the same thing with hockey, that, like, you know, you want it to go 5 overtimes, but I don't know.
Well, no, but you don't, but if you go into any inning, you shouldn't all of a sudden have it be declared a high leverage inning just by rule. You should have to put yourself in that situation.
But that to me is a philosophical argument, not an argument
about pitchers likely to be injured. We were having a philosophical argument.
Well, yeah, but you specifically said you were worried about pitchers' arms with a guy on second.
Because they throw differently when there's a guy on second than they would under normal circumstances, and 8 warm-up pitches doesn't get you warm enough for that.
Okay.
I got to be honest with you. I could care less about arm health. There's enough worry in the world from every Major League Baseball team crapping their pants every day at pitch counts. I'm not here for it. Go ahead. Throw your arm out. Are we serious? I mean, like,
well, let's
baseball.
Use an exploding ball then.
No, we don't need to do that. Just play baseball. I mean, Tim Lincecum threw, what, 148 pitches for a no-hitter? He lived.
Yeah, and he was out of baseball in 5 years.
Okay, well, most people are out of baseball in 5 years. 5 years is a good career. I mean, come on. It's, you know.
So you don't feel like you got cheated out of extra years of Lincecum at his best because of stuff like
because
that?
Because of one afternoon of throwing the baseball? No. I don't think one afternoon. The guy's thrown 4 billion pitches in his life. The 148 that one day was not the event horizon of the collapse of his career. Come on.
4 billion? That's quite a concept.
Play
one
along.
One of the reasons why,
play
I
along.
Mean, I don't want to play along. I'm a bad person. No, Lincecum is the sort of guy who, you know, quite frankly, you don't let him go 148 pitches under any circumstances. But they did it. You know, it's, you know, you got basically 4 great years out of him. And, you know, because they couldn't fix his mechanics because they were screwed up from the day he got there, I think that clearly shortened his career by a lot. And throwing him that many pitches as many times. And it wasn't just the 148 pitch game. It was the number of times he went, you know, 120, 124. I mean, he was a high pitch guy for some reason. And they did that a lot.
Because he didn't have great control, and he was a strikeout pitcher is the reason he was a high-pitch guy, and there was a different league. As strange as that may sound to say, Tim Lincecum's success in his career came at a time when there wasn't nearly the concern about pitch count or inning count or stress on guys' arms, and when, look, sometimes pitchers just burn out after a few years because that's the way life goes. And frankly, I think as we see this more, we're going to find out that's the case anyway. No matter how much you care about pitch count, sometimes guys' arms burn out. Other times they don't. And, you know, there's going to be some correlation, but it's certainly not the end-all, be-all if you're shutting guys down in fifth innings all the time. So, you know, that to me, I wouldn't say I don't care about arm health. I'd like guys to be healthy, but I do think we have to be reasonable here and understand that using your arm is your job if you're a major league pitcher.
Zach Greinke has used his arm to great effect against the San Francisco Giants throughout his career. Wherever the stop was, he's pitched well against San Francisco. Greinke gets the ball for Houston in the rubber game tonight. Trevor Cahill, who's been dealing with a fingernail all year, makes his Giants debut tonight in Houston. Zach Greinke, 20 career starts against the Giants. He is 13-3 with a 2.22 ERA. Ooh. That, I believe, Mike Kruko would call a little bit of ownage. So we'll see if the Giants can get to Greinke tonight. I'm interested in seeing Solano. Is he in the lineup? I haven't seen a lineup yet. I'm sure they're out because they're about to start playing. I mean, I think they're
definitely out. I believe they're just about getting underway.
Yeah. So, is Solano in there tonight? Can we have a look at that? I tell you what.
He is not.
That's a shame. I want to see that guy in there. That ab strain hopefully does not linger. Maybe a day off today, an off day for the entire team tomorrow. We'll have him in the Bay Bridge series when that gets underway on Friday at Oracle Park. When we come on back, we have sound from Hard Knocks that we got to get into, and Lucas and Nash have lovingly prepared a What If Wednesday segment for us, so we're going to do that today at 5 o'clock this afternoon. He covers college, the world of college everything, basically, Pat Forty, as well as anyone. We are going to have Pat Forty join us at 5 o'clock, Herm Edwards, Arizona State, a little bit later on. Don't you move a muscle. Damon Ratto and Kolsky here on 95.7 The Game. And we are brought to you by Chilton Auto Body, open to serve the Bay Area with contact-free auto body repair options, along with free pickup and delivery. Chilton Auto Body now offers virtual estimates and curbside contact-free service from the comfort of your own vehicle. Book an appointment today at ChiltonAutoBody.com. Damon Ratto and Kolsky on 95.7 The Game.
Now back to Damon, Ratto, and Kolsky on 95.7 The Game.
A little What If Wednesday right around the corner here on 95.7 The Game. Damon, Ratto, and Kolsky want to spend a little bit more time on Hard Knocks, though. We pulled some sound from last night's show, the debut episode of this season. Both NFL LA teams in full focus, and to juxtapose one against the other, I think, is kind of the interesting thing that this season might offer to us. Episode one was all about the Zoom meetings that have brought these NFL teams together with social distance responsibility and COVID testing dotting almost every segment of the entire first episode, except for the beefcake segment, which Ray Ratto truly enjoyed. Sean McVay, I think he was oiled up, Ray. What do you think? That's baby oil or canola? What is that?
I hope it was vegetable oil and he was taken inside later and fried to a crisp.
Let's talk about last night's, who I thought was the breakout star. Anthony Lynn, head coach of the Los Angeles Chargers, didn't really know much about him. Haven't really heard him talk. Certainly no one-on-one stuff ever beyond an NFL postgame interview. Anthony Lynn, last night, they opened up with him on a Zoom meeting with his team, and this is how HBO's Hard Knocks began.
I can't promise you you're not going to get infected. I got infected. I've talked to some people to say they're sick of this virus. All right, what the hell is that supposed to mean? Let me tell you something. You ain't promised next year. You ain't promised tomorrow. What I want to do is I want to limit your exposures, but then when that damn whistle blow, let's go kick somebody's ass and play some football. One team will do this better than the other 31. Trust me. It might as well be us.
I had no idea that we were recording that off a transistor radio. I mean, why don't we just roll on HBO and get great digital sound? Anyway, it was his Zoom call. All right, well, we'll hear if it sounds a little bit later on. But that was, him saying, look, we are all up against COVID-19. One team is going to handle it better than the rest. We would like to be that team. From what I saw in that debut episode, he seems committed to be that team. It looked like the Chargers were way more conscientious of mask wearing, social distancing, running just walk through plays with splits along their offensive linemen that you'd never see in a game. It looked like they were socially distancing the line of scrimmage. Meanwhile, the Rams were playing, you know, in shells, touching each other, all over each other, very few masks out on the field to play. And I'm not saying that that's negligent in any way, but it's two different ways of going about operating what looks like a contactless first couple weeks of football here.
It looked pretty negligent to me. I mean, football's got so many problems as it relates to the virus that I cannot imagine that the NFL was thrilled to see that, and I have a feeling that that'll get scrubbed before next week's episode. But to be
what do you mean scrubbed? Sort of,
I mean that you won't get to see the Rams without masks. I mean they'll. You know, that's going to change because there will be people in the league going, do you want to put this out again? You know, how many fires do you want to fight? So that's what I mean by scrubbed. I mean, they're going to put a foot into the Rams and go, stop being shown without masks. You don't get, that's not a choice you get to have.
I think
the Chargers are by definition, given, you know, the parameters of this show, they're the model.
You can say that it's a bad look to be putting out there, but isn't the premise of all this testing is that everybody who has made it through the filtration system that is put in between your car and our practice field, there's a filtration system which is supposed to leave us with nothing but COVID-free players out on the field today. So if I know 100% I don't have COVID-19, and Ray, I know 100% you don't have it either. The two of us could get together, sit close to each other, talk right in each other's faces to the end of time and never give each other COVID-19 if neither of us have it to begin with.
Well, one, the tests aren't foolproof, and three, there are 83 other people plus staff plus coaches. So it's not just you and me. It's everybody around you and me. And that's the problem, is the more people that you let in any bubble, the greater chance you run. So that's why I think they're not going to just trust tests, or more practically, that they shouldn't. That they should be taking every precaution so as not to leave people with the impression that there are some teams that have a greater chance of getting it than others.
Yeah, I mean, I do think this. There was some inconsistency in the first episode in a couple of notable ways, and that needs to get cleaned up, because what that reminds me of is baseball. You know, we get an announcement that there's hall monitors, and a week later, Zach Plesac's going out for dinner. I would like to know that everyone is sort of locked down and that this is being handled uniformly across the league. I agree with Ray on that 100%.
Well, you know, we only get to look at two teams. The other 30 are, you know, they don't have a camera crew there. I don't know what.
We'll find out, though.
Yeah. The bill's coming. There's no doubt. It's going to happen. Don't be surprised at it. Don't clutch your pearls when you find out a team has had spread. It's the take-the-punch mentality that the entire league has been asked to take. We're going to do everything we can. The perfect world that you're looking for never existed in the first place. Inherent risk is something that does not have to be explained to anybody on this field in the first place. You know, on the next play, you might not be able to walk again, but here you are. So obviously, there's an amount of safety you're willing to sacrifice to be here in the first place. And I know that you can't bring that paralysis back and give it to your grandmother, but it's up to you to not visit your grandmother as long as you're out here doing this. Like, everybody knows the rules. Let's see which team can manage it the best. Anthony Lynn, I really did think he was a breakout guy. He had more personality, more interaction than I was expecting. Here he is talking about the importance of social distancing on the practice field.
Hey, hurry up. Hey, stop where you at. I'm not going to bring you up after practice. I'm not going to bring up a group of guys. I want to try to limit that one exposure, okay? So wherever you are on the field, You just look when that last horn blow, you just listen for the 1, 2, 3. You say Chargers and you take it in. All right? 1, 2, 3. Great job on the focus today. Great job on the focus.
They're not getting together to put their hands in the middle for a huddle. The Rams are. The Rams are feeling all over each other, swim moves, techniques, and offensive linemen playing patty cake in a padless line of scrimmage with a defensive line breathing in each other's face. Not a lot of mask awareness. As a matter of fact, there was a part of this. Let's just jump to the Sean McVay. He is testing out the face shield, and it's really funny. There's a point in this episode of Hard Knocks where Sean McVay is preaching about how he needs to get better at wearing his mask, and he's not wearing his mask as he's making this speech. And by the way, he's very loud. He could have a piece of cloth in front of him, and everybody in the back of the room would be able to hear him. This man is not a quiet talker. So he doesn't need to worry about projecting. I guarantee you that McVay is going to wear that mask a little bit more in episode two. Here he was talking about what a weird world everyone was living in episode one.
And here's what we're going to do. Guys, wash your hands. Wear your mask or cover your face, okay? Be smart about that. When you leave the building, have enough respect for this ecosystem. Because it's like we're going to compete with our schemes, but we're going to win with our players and our people. And that's you guys. I never realized how much I missed you guys. How funny would it be, first team meeting, I come in with a blowtorch over my shoulder with this thing. All right, here we go. Welcome to 2020.
It's a welding today, boys.
I mean, he does. He looks like he's wearing a totally clear welder's shield. So that's why he's talking about the torch.
He sounds just like Gruden to me.
He does sound a lot like him.
Just like Gruden. Like that, the tone of voice is slightly different, but boy, the way he talks, the cadence, the excitement, there's so much Gruden in it.
I guess. He does have some of that salesman in him, which is why I think ESPN is so hot to try to pull him out of coaching and put him in a broadcast booth. So, yeah, I think, you know, above and beyond the fact that I've called him a towering narcissist already, he strikes me a lot like Gruden in that he always knows somebody's looking at him, and he projects to whoever that is.
Speaking of towering, Aaron Donald is more of a man than any of us will ever be.
God. Good.
I mean, specimen.
Was that in doubt?
No, it wasn't. But if anyone might have, basically, I had my wife ask me, what's wrong with you, when he was there working out, just looking jacked. I mean, he is.
I was going to say, that was the worst part of watching this episode, was seeing the man, the mountain that is Aaron Donald, while my wife sat next to me and sort of looked back and forth between the screen and me as if to say, are you in fact the same species as that individual? And the answer is no, I'm not. We're not. He is a something of his own. It's remarkable. And what stood out to me about it is not that he's, again, what he is physically, because we've all seen the shirtless Instagrams. It's that even the other football players look at that guy and go, wow. Like, yeah. Everybody there is looking at Aaron Donald like, that ain't normal.
Yeah, I can see that. I have been married long enough that my wife does not even enter into those discussions at all. She sort of knows that we are loosely of the same species. But she doesn't really say, what happened to you? Because she knows what happened to me.
She's comfortable with the disappointment, yeah, that you've become.
It's not a disappointment. It was an expectation.
Two legitimate emotions I thought were on display last night. Joey Bosa getting a little emotional at his contract signing, talking about the conversation he had with his dad. Like, that wasn't faked. That was
cool.
That was. Hey, my father passed down a skill set to me that I just made more money with in one day than my dad made in several lifetimes, and my dad is proud of me today. Yeah, my dad is very proud of me today. That'll get a man's voice to crack under a lot of circumstances. And what's crazy is that both Bosa boys are about to set the record for highest paid defensive end in football history. One's already done it. The next one's probably about to do it. The other genuine emotion was Jalen Ramsey getting angry at the media during a Zoom meeting. Pardon me. He leaves the meeting, comes back to the meeting, and then gives the answer that had he just given that answer in the first place, he would have avoided all the hard feelings that were in the room. I mean, here's the thing. Everyone knows that you can't answer that question about your contract. Are you comfortable playing football until your extension is done? And he's going to give you the old answer that says, you know, I'm not worried about it. I got my agent to work on it. All right, but that's not enough to get the dogs off your tail. I mean, like, for a guy whose job it is to run backwards defending the best he can, the stuff being thrown at him, how he hasn't figured out at this point in his career the better way to answer a question, not to placate the media, but just to get him off your back. Like, the answer that he came back to give in anger, if he had just said the exact same words without any anger the first time around, the media would have been completely satisfied in him dropping, you know, the equivalent of, it is what it is. That's not anything that they can work with. Instead of giving a one-sentence answer, give them three, and they'll stop bothering you. Again, I just, like, Kevin Durant never got this. Jalen Ramsey clearly doesn't get it. It's really easy to throw these muckety-mucks off your tail. You don't even have to throw them a bone. Just throw them a Scooby snack. They'll chase it. They're all desperate.
I think one of the things, and I'm not speaking specifically of this, but in general, players have figured out that the media in general has a diminishing role in what they do or how they're perceived, because they've taken that role on themselves. But it bothers them that the media is still fed by management or by agents, and so they still don't have the voice they want. So ultimately, the mistake that they all make is that they don't figure out how to co-opt the media the same way that most management guys do, which is to talk to them. Because truthfully, in every sport, when you need access, the guy who gives you access gets in return the benefit of the doubt, even if he doesn't deserve it. It's just a way of thinking tactically about your future that LeBron James figured out and Michael Jordan didn't. And Michael Jordan still ends up being a billionaire, so he wins anyway. But LeBron James is viewed, I think, as the more admirable guy because he has a way of getting a message out that resounds with people that Jordan never really wanted to do.
But the media worlds were so different, Ray. It's hard to compare the two. I mean, it really is. LeBron lives
in a world that's
so much different from the world where Jordan could say, screw you guys, and everyone ran away.
But also, God love Michael Jordan. Is it possible that LeBron is looked at as a more admirable human being because he is, in fact, a more admirable human being? I mean, is that totally unrealistic?
Nobody knows that he's a more admirable human being if he doesn't let them know that he's a more admirable human being.
Sure, but I think that's the thing. To Damon's point,
one of
the reasons
why people don't actively dislike Stephen Curry, even in other cities, is that he lets them know. And whether you do it through a writer or whether you do it with your own production company and more guys who have the kind of financial wherewithal and interest that he does, they do it themselves. You have to present yourself to the general public if that's the game you want to play. And the thing about, you know, a lot of football players is that it's either driven out of you culturally early on, or you let your resentment guide your public image. And every time you do that, management wins. And they'll hold it against you when the time comes for them to do so.
Barry Bonds could be in the Hall of Fame had he just been a little nicer. I mean, nothing. There it is, right there, right? I mean, like, all the outrage, all the shake and the fist anger. Like, seriously, if Barry Bonds had been a little nicer to Ann Killian, she's voting for him for the Hall of Fame. Period, end of story.
I don't know about that, because Sammy Sosa's not in. He was nice to everybody.
No, Mark McGuire's not in. He was on the surface nice to everybody. He did not have a good relationship with a single Chicago beat writer. They kind of hated him, and it ended terribly.
People liked McGuire.
Well, McGuire didn't get in largely because of the years when he was injured. I mean, when you look at his total resume, I'm telling you, because I talked to people who didn't vote for him, and I was one of them, and the argument I always heard was not steroids. It was missed too many years, didn't have enough years at the peak of the game, only ended up with 1,600 hits, all things that are measurements of guys who missed too much time. I don't think McGuire was kept out because of steroids. I think McGuire was kept out because he was hurt too often and he was a 230 hitter too many years. He played 16 years and was at his peak for six. And because there are more and more sort of stat nerds voting for the Hall of Fame, that was the principal complaint that I heard.
Okay. I think it's a remarkable coincidence that nobody with public links to steroids has gotten in, but that it just, with McGuire, happens to be more about his stats. That doesn't make a ton of sense to me.
Well, okay.
I got to tell you, I didn't think that Mark McGuire had definitely in the Hall of Fame statistics either. But given the fact that you are going to have a hard time telling the story of baseball without him, like I would have leaned towards, again, the legend is as important as the fact. And I guess I'm Ramona Shelburne. I'm a narrative voter. Is she getting clobbered for being a narrative voter because she thought that LeBron did more for the Lakers than Giannis did for the Bucks? Therefore, she gave LeBron her MVP vote. And I see people very angry at Ramona today. Let's hear it. Well, I was just told we have sound.
Not vote for him for MVP. I voted for LeBron James because I tend to be more of a narrative-based voter, and I feel like LeBron James took a Lakers team that had missed the playoffs 6 years in a row up to the top spot in the West after all of the dysfunction of the summer before. So I think he gets credit for that as well.
Here's the thing. Just be consistent. If that's who you are this year, I hope that's what you bring to the table next year. I hope it's what you brought the year before. You know, I'm just looking for consistency in voting patterns.
She also was based in L.A. So, again, she had sort of the inherent and unintended bias of voting for someone she saw all the time as opposed to voting for someone that she only saw largely on television. And there are lots of voters like that, and I don't hold it against them. But there are also a bunch of voters, you know, for NBA awards who immediately go to Basketball Reference, and they immediately nerd out, and they immediately sort of, you know, look at the game like John Hollinger and don't listen to narrative. So and that's why there are 125 people voting for that, because they're letting all schools of thought run rampant.
Well, but that's also just the nature of what's happening there. That I think leagues do this on purpose, first of all. They fail to specifically define the MVP because they want people to use their own methodology because they want debate about the winner. And let's be honest, like, if we're debating league MVP between LeBron and Giannis, They're both pretty good answers, you know?
Maybe hairs.
Yeah, and very rarely do you have a bunch of votes go for someone who really shouldn't be in the conversation.
It's absolutely true. Yeah.
I
don't think we're saying different things. I'm just saying that...
No, I know.
Individual voters come at this from different angles, but the strength of the award is that 125 people who, you know, view the game differently eventually come to a solution. And the winner is rarely somebody who didn't deserve it.
Also, speaking of deserving things, I also just checked and want to point out that the top 25 on the career home run list, every single one of them is either active in the Hall of Fame or publicly tied to steroids. So to me, that I'm not saying McGuire's other stats helped him, but my suspicion is if he was a 300 career hitter, he'd still be on the outside looking in.
I would say not. I would say not. I think he would have gotten in.
We do have a fact. I mean, this is undebatable. The A's won today. They have the most wins in the American League. Will come home, spend a day off tomorrow, and then begin taking on the Giants in the Bay Bridge Series. The A's end up taking 2 of 3 down in Anaheim with
and
a win
Giants
today.
The Giants are winning.
8-4. And there you go. So we got interesting all around us when we come on back. A What If Wednesday at 5 o'clock. Pat Forty joins us. We're looking forward to that. Herm Edwards, one of the best people to talk to in really the college football world at 5:30 this afternoon. If you missed him before, stick around for all of it today. Damon Ratto and Kolsky brought to you by Fremont Bank. Full service banking, no compromises.
Now back to Damon Ratto and Kolsky on 95.7 The Game.
Hey, what if I told you we weren't going to have a 5-overtime hockey game today? Would you believe me? Of course you would. These things are rare. One happened yesterday. Probably takes it off the board. Happening 2 days in a row, just historically speaking. We have an awful lot of basketball seeding in the West to still be determined. The Eastern Conference is locked in now. 1 through 8 are opening round playoff games. Eastern Conference NBA bubble action. You're going to get Bucks versus Magic. That's your 1 through 8. The 2 and 7 is Raptors versus Nets. The 3 and 6 is Celtics Sixers. The Heat Pacers is the 4-5 series. And that is going to be worth the price of admission. What sounded pretty unsexy, all of a sudden this bubble, woo, Pacers Heat, that's going to get sexy. And you're going to have Jimmy Butler out there just motivating. That's gonna be an awful lot of fun. Awful lot of fun. I like that. Anything jump out to you there, guys? Before we what if ourselves?
Yeah,
the
Washington.
Round.
Oh, I was gonna say Washington has fallen behind the Bulls in the Eastern
Damn
Conference
right.
standings.
Don't
it
worry,
took a
lottery
lot for them
odds
to
are...
do that. They went 0-8, and nobody was surprised.
The Bulls still get better lottery odds, so don't worry about that. In seriousness, what jumps out to me is less Indiana-Miami and more Miami-Milwaukee, because I think that's where the Bucks' trouble starts. The way they have looked – what'd you say, Lucas? Yeah, I think people can figure out that that would be the second round. I think that's where Milwaukee's trouble starts. They are obviously not going to have trouble with the Orlando Magic. But the way they've struggled to close games makes me think a team like the Heat is a real threat to them, where they have a guy like Jimmy Butler who is adept at closing games. And they certainly have the defensive players to make things tough on Milwaukee in general. I was so convinced the Bucks were the best team at the end of the regular season before the bubble, and I just don't think that anymore at all.
Eric Spoelstra, maybe the least appreciated damn good coach in the NBA. So, that second round matchup could be tasty. I'm ready for any and all scenarios. What if I told you we were braced for just about anything on a What If Wednesday?
What if I told you hindsight is always 20/20?
The Minnesota Timberwolves select Stephen Curry.
That everything happens for a reason.
With the first selection in the 2005 NFL draft, the San Francisco 49ers select Aaron Rodgers, quarterback to California.
What if I told you it's time for What If Wednesday on Damon, Ratto, and Kolsky.
All right, we go back to the studio. Lucas, now we just... We don't want you just whispering things in Matt's ear. You get to talk to everyone. What do you got for us this afternoon?
Well, we just went through the Eastern Conference playoff standings, what the first round's going to be. Let's pick up right there. All season long, one of the biggest punching bags in the NBA has been the 76ers. A lot of people say the pieces don't really fit together, guys playing out of position. They're inconsistent. They're not coached that well. Now Ben Simmons is probably going to miss the rest of the season. And once again, we won't really know what the Ben Simmons-Embiid pairing does for you. What if the Sixers get bounced in the first round, and you're Elton Brand? What are you doing with this team moving forward?
You're blowing it up. I mean, you're blowing it up. I mean, the amount of this doesn't fit, you have all the evidence you need, I think, to prove that this doesn't necessarily fit. Even a certain degree of success means you might be going back to the drawing board, because if the Sixers operate better with Embiid being dominant and, you know, Simmons, look, Simmons picked the wrong time to really hurt a kneecap, didn't he? I mean, this was supposed to be a who are you about to be in your NBA career moment, and he can't show that now. His trade value, you'd think, would take a step. I don't know, man. It's 76ers are caught between a decent team and a team that has pieces that do not fit.
It is the great failing of the process that while you can try to back your way into becoming relevant, there is luck that you cannot control, program, or set up that can ruin that plan in a heartbeat. And between, you know, taking a gamble on Nerlens Noel that didn't work, drafting Markel Fultz, and now the injuries to Simmons and the struggles that he and Embiid have had figuring out each other, it sort of says that the best laid plans are very fungible, because there's always an element of luck in every sport. And Philadelphia's good luck is now being sort of answered back with bad luck. And, I mean, sometimes you eat the bear and sometimes the bear eats you. No more complicated than that.
Obviously, luck is a factor. That's not an argument against the process at all, because luck is a factor for everybody. So that to me is totally separate issues. As far as this team goes, if I'm Elton Brand, I'm screening my phone calls, because he can blow this thing up. The problem is not the process. The problem is not Embiid and Simmons. Yes, they don't play great together, and in a perfect world, you'd probably trade one of them. And if not for other things, that might be what I'd say I'd do if I was Elton Brand. The problem is what has torpedoed this team is not Simmons and Embiid, both of whom are tremendous value either way. It's Toby Harris with a max deal. That is a problem, and that's a problem you're going to really struggle to move. You know, the rest of this roster, Al Horford being paid what he's getting paid to do what he's doing for this team, that's a big problem, and I don't know how you can move on from Al Horford. So to me, yeah, they could move Simmons or Embiid and probably get a decent haul in return, and that is probably what they have to do, along with move on from Brett Brown. But they can't move on from Harris and Horford, and to me, those are bigger problems.
7 minutes to Pat 40, who's going to join us at 5 o'clock here on 95.7 The Game. Lucas, question number two.
We'll stick with NBA real quick. What if the Suns go 8-0 and miss the playoffs? They can win tomorrow, and they still need help. They need either the Spurs or the Grizzlies to lose. Excuse me. They need the Trailblazers or the Grizzlies to lose to sneak in. What if the Suns go 8-0 and miss the playoffs?
No one cares. It's the Phoenix Suns.
Let me try to flesh that out a little bit, but it's going to be the same answer. Having won 8 in a row, they still end up 34-39. And they look like a 34-39 team because a lot of the pieces outside Booker and Ayton are not very good. And the test of a general manager is how do you do pieces 3 through 12? Because nobody's winning with just a 1 and 2 anymore. The Warriors didn't do it. Before that, the Spurs didn't do it. You need to have great players, and you need to have very good complementary players. And the Suns got hot at a great time, and people got to notice them. But it's still the same team that they were before, which is interesting but limited.
I think they're actually not at all the same team they were before, because that team, for the most part, didn't have DeAndre Ayton available for a lot of the time, and he's been really good in the bubble. I think they do have good supporting players. Dario Saric, Aaron Baines, Ricky Rubio are all serious contributors. Cam Johnson is an interesting rookie. Mikal Bridges is a young guy who's played well for them. And yeah, ultimately, if they win 8 in a row and don't make the playoffs, tough luck. You're the Suns. You built this house yourself. Now you got to live in it. That's the way it is. But I think we're all better off for having had them in the bubble. They were fun to watch. They were an exciting team. They played good basketball on my television, and I'm in favor. So all in all, I think this was great for the Suns, playoffs or not.
Which team is going to benefit the most from conjugal visits in the bubble?
They're not having them. So, you know, the real question is who's going to suffer the most from not having conjugal visits? It's the guys without wives who are in trouble.
Oh no, you're going to be allowed to bring a girlfriend in, but just not a girlfriend that slid into your DM. No bookings, lovelies, no bookings.
Well, that's the thing. I think that there has to be a level of sort of long-termedness to your significant other. So I think a lot of young guys are in trouble here.
You got a fallback, though. Yeah, and the fallback... we've already said too much. Go ahead. What's the third question today, Lucas?
Gentlemen, don't look now, but Charlie Blackmon is hitting 500 on this short season. Over the last six games, he's hitting 17 for 23. That's over 700. Chuck Nasty threw 17 total games, more than a quarter through the season. Yeah, it's one of the best nicknames in sports, Chuck Nasty. He's hitting 500. What if Blackmon breaks Ted Williams' batting average record, stands at 406? What do you do with this season, these types of stats?
You pat him on the back. He said you had a hell of a 60-game run, but you'll never be remembered as a single-season 400 hitter because that's not what you are. Anything that comes out of this odd year gets an asterisk, not because it doesn't count, but because it's such a different set of parameters that it needs to stand out as unequal than any other measurement we've ever given a baseball season. So, look, it'd be an interesting factoid. Go ahead, put up the numbers. Hit 410. God bless you. Hit 450. Donovan Solano finishes the year hitting 500. Ted Williams was better.
Plus, Blackmon went 0 for 4 today, so the dream is dead anyway.
Bum.
He stinks. Chuck, not so nasty, am I right?
No,
look, everyone knows that it's not going to count. It's a great 60-game stretch if he does that. Very few people even hit 400 for 60 games. That's remarkable. You're a great hitter if you can do that, and you're absolutely not Ted Williams at all.
What if I told both you guys Pat Forty's joining us right now, which means I'm going to welcome everybody to 5 o'clock 3 minutes early today. Hello.
He's also a bum.
You're listening to 95.7 The Game, KGMZ FM and HD1 San Francisco, a radio.com sports station.
In terms of college football headlines, yesterday was pretty much tantamount to the day the earth stood still. What an afternoon, and to sort it out without even really knowing what it's going to look like going forward over the next few weeks. We are very happy to welcome in Pat Forty here, 95.7 The Game. Thank you very much, Pat. I'm sure Ray's got a cavalcade of insults for you today as we welcome you into the show. Thank you for joining us.
Pleased to be with you, even Ratto. Thank you.
How far did your jaw drop? Did you need any help picking it up when you saw the Big Ten and the Pac-12 make yesterday's decisions?
Not really at all. You know, I mean, the Pac-12 was a slam dunk. The Big Ten, I think, was a foregone conclusion that became a little less foregone as the noise entered the system, I guess, if you will, Sunday and Monday with this kind of very unusual, public relations campaign from players, coaches, and then, the president and vice president of the United States, to play. And, you know, I think that at least had the Big Ten hitting pause. I think Kevin Warren has handled a brutal first year on the job as Big Ten commissioner well. The only thing that when he had the votes like at 12-2 on Sunday/Monday morning, they should have just taken the vote and been done with it. Instead, he allowed, you know, a day and a half of turmoil to slip in there. But I was not surprised that either one of those conferences in the big picture shut it down.
And of the three conferences that at least now are still planning to go full steam ahead, if things go worse than they already have, what's the first of those conferences to bail out, or are they in the, we're doing this no matter how many casualties we take?
Now, I think that all of them will have an exit strategy, Ray, and I'm not sure there's one that's more likely to exit than any of the others. Maybe the ACC, You know, I think Big 12 and SEC are looking for all the reasons to play. The ACC is like, well, okay, if you're going to do it, we'll do it too. But I think any of them, like if things start really going sideways, yeah, I think that they're all susceptible to bailing. And really, if one of them bails, I think all three would probably bail. You know, that's wait and see, but that would be my suspicion.
What do you know about what teams are allowed to do while their seasons are postponed, canceled, whatever the situation is? Are there meetings? Are there practices? Can they even gather in the same location? Are they staying on campus? What do you know about what's going to happen logistically?
Yeah, you know, I think that's one of the misnomers and misdirection plays that a lot of coaches put out there while they were trying to cloud this issue was, you know, these guys are safer here. We're going to take care of them. They're going to be involved. But then if we don't have a season, oh, they're going to be lost, which I thought was paternalistic at best and disingenuous. The reality is the vast majority of them will still be on campus. They will still be working out. They will be subject to the NCAA 20-hour rule, but they'll be able to work out for 20 hours, be at the facility, get tested, get academic support, get nutrition, all the things that they've gotten. They're not going to be having a regular practice schedule and playing games. That's really, to my knowledge, the only things that they're going to be missing. So this idea that, you know, all this support structure is going to disappear without playing games, I think was a misdirection play intended to ratchet up the pressure to play.
Pat Forty here on Damon Ratto and Kolsky. Is Nebraska seriously trying to throw weight around? Let's not forget, they're a girls volleyball team in an otherwise football conference now.
That's correct. That is the strong point. It's not football. They're basically, in the last 5 years, they've been the ninth best team in the Big Ten. And they're acting like, yeah, they're trying to muscle the league and say, we'll play anybody. If I were the Big Ten, I would say, go. Let me help you pack. Don't let Iowa hit you on the backside on the way out. Leave. You have been an underachiever since we brought you in. You're paying a coach $5 million a year. He's underachieving. He's gone 4-8 and 5-7.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.